Chapter 24. Honey in the Tea. Egwene knew from the start that her strange captivity would be difficult, yet she believed that embracing pain as the Aiel did would be the easiest part. After all, she had been beaten severely when she paid her toll to the Wise Ones for lying, strapped by one after another in turn, so she had experience. But embracing pain did not mean just giving way to it rather than fighting. You had to draw the pain inside of you and welcome it as a part of you. Avienda said you must be able to smile and laugh with joy or sing while the worst of the pain still gripped you. That was not so easy at all. That first morning before dawn in Sylviana's study, she did her best while the Mistress of Novices plied a hard-soled slipper on her bared bottom. She made no effort to stifle her sobs when they came, or later, her wordless howls. When her legs wanted to kick, she allowed them to flail until the Mistress of Novices trapped them under one of hers, awkwardly because of Sylviana's skirts, and then she let her toes drum the floor while her head tossed wildly. She tried to draw the pain inside her, to drink it in like breath. Pain was as much a part of life as breathing. That was how the Aiel saw life. But oh, light, it hurt! When she was finally allowed to straighten after what seemed a very long time, she flinched when her shift and dress fell against her flesh. The white wool seemed heavy as lead. She attempted to welcome the scalding heat. It was hard, though, so very hard. Still, it seemed that her sobbing stopped very quickly of its own accord, and her flow of tears dried up rapidly. She did not snivel or writhe. She studied herself in the mirror on the wall with its fading gilt. How many thousands of women had peered into that mirror over the years? Those who were disciplined in this room were always required to study their own reflection afterward and think over why they had been punished. But that was not why she did it. Her face was still red, yet already it looked calm. Despite the painful heat in her bottom, she actually felt calm. Perhaps she should try singing? Perhaps not. Plucking a white linen handkerchief from her sleeve, she carefully dried her cheeks. Sylviana studied her with a look of satisfaction before replacing the slipper in the narrow cabinet opposite the mirror. "I think I got your attention from the start, or I'd have gone harder," she said dryly, patting the bun on the back of her head. "I doubt I will see you again soon, in any case. You may like to know that I asked questions as you requested." Melair had already begun asking. "The woman is Liana Sharif, though the light knows how." Trailing off, shaking her head, she pulled her chair back around behind the writing table and sat. "She was most anxious about you, more so than about herself. You may visit her in your free time, if you have any free time. I'll give instructions. She's in the open cells. And now you had better run if you want anything to eat before your first class." "Thank you," Egwene said, and turned toward the door. Sylviana sighed heavily. "No curtsy, child?" Dipping her pen in the silver-mounted ink jar, she began to write in the punishment ledger, a neat, precise hand. "I will see you at midday. It seems you will eat both of your first two meals back in the tower standing." Egwene could have left it there, but in the night, while waiting for the sitters to gather in the hall in Telairun Riod, she had decided on the fine line she must walk. She meant to fight, yet she had to do it while appearing to go along, to some extent at least, within the limits she set herself. Refusing every order would mean appearing merely obstinate, and perhaps would get her confined to a cell where she would be useless. But some commands she must not obey if she was to maintain any scrap of dignity, and that she had to do, more than scraps. She could not allow them to deny who she was, however hard they insisted. "The Ammerlin seat curtsies to no one," she said calmly, knowing full well the reaction she would get. Sylviana's face hardened, and she took up her pen again. "I will see you at the dinner hour as well. I suggest you leave without speaking further, unless you wish to end spending the entire day over my knee." Egwene left without speaking, and without curtsying. A fine line, like a wire suspended over a deep pit, but she had to walk it. To her surprise, Alviarin was pacing up and down in the hall outside, wrapped in her white-fringed shawl and hugging herself, staring at something in the unseen distance. She knew the woman was no longer Elida's keeper, if not why she had been removed so suddenly. Spying in Telairanriod gave only glimpses and snatches. It was an uncertain reflection of the waking world in so many ways. Alviarin must have heard her yowling, but strangely, Egwene felt no shame. She was fighting an odd battle, and in battle you took wounds. The normally icy white did not appear so cool today. In fact, she seemed quite agitated, her lips parted and her eyes hot. Egwene offered her no courtesies, yet Alviarin only gave her a baleful glare before entering Sylviana's study. A fine line. A little down the corridor, a pair of reds stood watching, one round-faced, the other slender, both cool-eyed, with shawls draped along their arms so the long red fringe was displayed prominently. Not the same pair who had been there when she woke, but they were not present by happenstance. They were not precisely guards, and then again they were not precisely not guards, either. She did not curtsy to these, either. They watched her without expression. Before she had taken more than half a dozen steps along the red and green floor tiles, she heard a woman's pained howling start up behind her, hardly muffled at all by the heavy door to Sylviana's study. So Alviarin was taking a penance, and not doing well to be shrieking at the top of her lungs so soon, unless she also was trying to embrace pain, which seemed unlikely. Egwene wished she knew why Alviarin was undergoing penance, if it was an imposed penance. A general had scouts and eyes and ears to inform him on his enemy. She had only her own eyes and her own ears and what little she could learn in the unseen world. Any scrap of knowledge might prove useful, though, so she must dig for every one possible. Breakfast or no breakfast, she returned to her tiny room in the novice quarters long enough to wash her face in cool water at the washstand and comb her hair. That comb, which had been in her belt pouch, was among the few personal belongings she retained. In the night, the clothes she had been wearing when captured vanished, replaced by novice white, but the dresses and shifts that hung from pegs on the white wall truly were hers. Stored away when she was raised accepted, they still carried small tags stitched with her name sewn into their hems. The tower was never wasteful. You never knew when a new girl would fit an old set of clothes. But having nothing to wear save novice white did not make her a novice, whatever Elida and the others believed. Not until she was sure that her face was no longer red and she looked as collected as she felt did she leave. When you had few weapons, your appearance could be won. The same two reds were waiting on the railed gallery to shadow her. The dining hall, where novices ate, lay on the lowest level of the tower to one side of the main kitchen. It was a large, white-walled chamber, plain, though the floor tiles showed all the Aja colors, and filled with tables, each of which could accommodate 6 or 8 women on small benches. 100 or more white-clad women were sitting at those tables, chattering away over breakfast. Elida must be very set up over their number. The tower had not held so many novices in years. Doubtless even news of the tower breaking had been enough to put the thought of going to Tar Valon into some heads. Egwene was not impressed. These women filled barely half the dining hall, if that, and there was another like it one floor up, closed now for centuries. Once she gained the tower, that second kitchen would be opened again, and the novices still would need to eat by shifts. Something unknown since well before the Trolloc Wars. Nicola caught sight of her as soon as she walked in. The woman appeared to have been watching for her, and nudged the novices to either side. Silence slid across the tables in a wave, and every head turned as Egwene glided down the central aisle. She looked neither to left nor right. Halfway to the kitchen door, a short, slim novice with long, dark hair suddenly stuck out a foot and tripped her. Catching her balance just short of falling on her face, she turned coolly. Another skirmish. The young woman had the pale look of a Kyrianan. This close, Egwene could be sure that she would be tested for accepted unless she had other failings, but the tower was good at rooting out such things. "What is your name?" she said. "Alvester," the young woman replied, her accent confirming her face. "Why do you want to know? So you can carry tales to Sylviana? It will do you no good. Everyone will say they saw nothing." "A pity that, Alvis dear. You want to become Aes Sedai and give up the ability to lie, yet you want others to lie for you. Do you see any inconsistency in that?" Alvesteer's face reddened. "Who are you to lecture me?" "I am the Amarlin Seat. A prisoner, but still the Amarlin Seat." Alvesteer's big eyes widened, and whispers buzzed through the room as Egwene walked on to the kitchen. They had not believed she would still claim the title while garbed in white and sleeping among them. As well to disabuse them of that notion so quickly. The kitchen was a large, high-ceilinged room with gray-tiled floors, where the roasting spits in the long stone fireplace were still, but the iron stoves and ovens radiated enough heat that she would have begun perspiring immediately had she not known how to ignore it. She had labored in this kitchen often enough, and it seemed certain she would again. Dining halls surrounded it on three sides, for the accepted and for Aes Sedai as well as novices. Laris, the mistress of the kitchens, was waddling about, sweaty-faced, in a spotless white apron that could have made three novice dresses, waving her long wooden spoon like a scepter as she directed cooks and undercooks and scullions who scurried for her as fast as they would have for any queen. Perhaps faster. A queen would be unlikely to give anyone a smack with her scepter for moving too slowly. A great deal of the food seemed to be going on to trays, sometimes worked silver, sometimes carved wood and perhaps gilded, that women carried away through the door to the sisters' main dining hall. Not kitchen-serving women with the white flame of Tarvalin on their bosoms, but dignified women in well-cut woolens with an occasional touch of embroidery, sisters' personal servants who would make the long climb back to the Aja quarters. Any Aes Sedai could eat in her own rooms if she wished, though it meant channeling to warm the food again, yet most enjoyed company at meals. At least they had. That steady stream of women carrying out cloth-covered trays was a confirmation that the White Tower was spider-webbed with cracks. She should have felt pleasure at that. Elida stood on a platform that was ready to crumble beneath her. But the tower was home. All she felt was sadness, and anger at Elida, too. That one deserved to be pulled down simply for what she had done to the tower since gaining the stolen staff. Laris gave her one long look, drawing in her chin until she had a fourth, then returned to brandishing her spoon and looking over an undercook's shoulder. The woman had helped Swan and Lyanna escape once, so her loyalties to Elida were weak. Would she help another now? She was certainly making every effort to avoid looking in Egwene's direction again. Another undercook who likely did not know her from any other novice. A smiling woman still working on her second chin handed her a wooden tray with a large, stout cup of steaming tea and a thick, white-glazed plate of bread, olives, and crumbly white cheese that she carried back into the dining hall. Silence fell again, and once more every eye centered on her. Of course. They knew she had been summoned to the Mistress of Novices. They were waiting to see whether she would eat standing. She wanted very much to ease herself onto the hard wooden bench, but she made herself sit down normally, which reignited the flames, of course. Not as strongly as before, yet strong enough to make her shift before she could stop herself. Strangely, she felt no real desire to grimace or squirm. To stand, yes, but not the other. The pain was part of her. She accepted it without struggle. She tried to welcome it, yet that still seemed beyond her. She tore a piece of bread. There were weevils in the flour here, too, it appeared. And slowly the conversation in the room started up again, quietly because novices were expected not to make too much noise. At her table also the talk resumed, though no one made any effort to include her. That was just as well. She was not here to make friends among the novices, nor to have them see her as one of themselves. No, her purpose was far different. Leaving the hall with the novices after returning her tray to the kitchen, she found another pair of reds waiting for her. One was Katerina Alruddin, vulpine in copiously red-slashed gray, a mass of raven hair falling in waves to her waist, and her shawl looped over her elbows. "Drink this," Katerina said imperiously, extending a pewter cup in one slim hand. "All of it, mind." The other red, dark and square-faced, adjusted her shawl impatiently and grimaced. Apparently, she disliked acting as a serving woman even by association, or perhaps it was dislike for what was in the cup. Suppressing a sigh, Egwene drank. The weak fork-root tea looked and tasted like water tinged a faint brown, with just a hint of mint. Almost a memory of mint, rather than the taste itself. Her first cup had been soon after waking, the Red Sisters on duty eager to be done with shielding and about their own business. Katerina had let the hours slip a little, yet even without this cup, she doubted she would have been able to channel very strongly for some time yet. Certainly not with enough strength to be useful. "I don't want to be late for my first class," she said, handing the cup back. Katerina took it, though she seemed surprised to realize that she had. Egwene glided on after the novices before the sister could object, or remember to call her down for failing to curtsy. That first class, in a plain windowless room where 10 novices occupied benches for 30 or more, was every bit the disaster she expected. Not a disaster for her, however, no matter the outcome. The instructor was Idrella Menford, a lanky, hard-eyed woman who had already been accepted when Egwene first came to the tower. She still wore the white dress with the 7 bands of color at hem and cuffs. Egwene took a seat at the end of a bench, once again without consideration for her tenderness. That had lessened, though not very far. Drink in the pain. Standing on a small dais at the front of the room, Idrella looked down her long nose with more than a spark of satisfaction at seeing Egwene in white once more. It almost softened her frown, a fixture with Idrella. "You have all gone beyond making simple balls of fire," she told the class. "But let's see what our new girl is capable of. She used to think a great deal of herself, you know." Several of the novices tittered. "Make a ball of fire, Egwene. Go on, child." A ball of fire? That was one of the earliest things novices learned. What was she about? Opening herself to the source, Egwene embraced Sayidar, let it rush into her. The forkroot allowed only a trickle, a thread where she was accustomed to torrents, yet it was the power. And, trickle or no, it brought all of the life and joy of Sayidar, all the heightened awareness of herself and the room around her. Awareness of herself meant her smarting bottom suddenly felt freshly slippered again, but she did not shift. Breathe in the pain. She could smell the faint aroma of soap from the novice's morning wash, see a tiny vein pulsing on Idrella's forehead. Part of her wanted to clout the woman's ear with a flow of air, but given the amount of power she commanded now, Idrella would barely feel it. Instead, she channeled fire and air to produce a small ball of green fire that floated in front of her. A pale, pitiful thing it was, actually transparent. "Very good," Idrella said sarcastically. Ah, yes. She had just wanted to begin by showing the novices how weak Egwene's channeling was. "Release, Sayidar. Now, class." Egwene added a blue ball, then a brown and a gray, making them spin around each other. "Release the source," Idrella said brusquely. A yellow ball joined the others, a white, and finally a red ball. Quickly she added rings of fire, one inside the other, around the whirling balls. Red came first this time because she wanted it smallest, green last and largest. Had she been able to choose an Aja, it would have been the green. 7 rings of fire rotated, no 2 in the same direction, around 7 balls of fire that carried out an intricate dance at the heart. Pale and thin they might be, yet it was an impressive display beyond dividing her flows 14 ways. Juggling with the power was not all that much easier than juggling with your hands. "Stop that!" Idrella shouted. "Stop it!" The glow of Sayidar enveloped the teacher, and a switch of air struck Egwene hard across the back. "I said stop it!" The switch struck again, then again. Egwene calmly kept the rings spinning, the balls dancing. After Sylviana's hard-swung slipper, it was easy to drink in the pain of Idrella's blows, if not to welcome it. Would she ever be able to smile while she was being beaten? Katarina and the other red appeared in the doorway. "What is going on in here?" the raven-haired sister demanded. Her companion's eyes widened when she saw what Egwene was doing. It was very unlikely that either of them could divide their flows so far. The novices all popped to their feet and curtsied when the Aes Sedai entered, of course. Egwene remained seated. Idrella spread her banded skirts, looking flustered. "She won't stop," she wailed. "I told her to, but she won't." "Stop that, Egwene," Katarina ordered firmly. Egwene maintained her weaves until the woman opened her mouth again. Only then did she release Sidar and stand. Katarina's mouth snapped shut, and she took a deep breath. Her face retained its Aes Sedai serenity, but her eyes glittered. "You will run to Sylviana's study and tell her that you disobeyed your instructor and disrupted a class. Go." Pausing long enough to straighten her skirts, when she obeyed, she must not do so with any appearance of eagerness or haste, Egwene squeezed past the two Aes Sedai and glided up the hallway. "I told you to run," Katarina said sharply behind her. A flow of air struck her still sensitive bottom. "Accept the pain." Another blow. "Drink in the pain like breath." A third, hard enough to stagger her. "Welcome the pain." "Unhand me, Jezreel," Katarina snarled. "I'll do no such thing," the other sisters said with a strong tyrant accent. "You go too far, Katarina. A swatter too is permitted, but punishing her further belongs to the mistress of novices. Light at this rate, you'll leave her unable to walk before she reaches Sylviana." Katarina breathed heavily. "Very well," she said at last. "But she can add disobeying a sister to her list of offenses. I will inquire, Egwene, so don't think you can let it slip your mind." When she stepped into the mistress of novices' study, Sylviana's eyebrows rose in surprise. "Again so soon? Fetch the slipper from the cabinet, child, and tell me what you've done now." After two more classes and two more visits to Sylviana's study, she refused to be made mock of, and if an accepted did not want her doing a thing better than the accepted herself could, the woman should not ask her to do it at all. Plus her foreordained midday appointment between, the stern-faced woman decided that she was to have healing to begin each day. "Else you'll soon be too bruised to spank without bringing blood. But don't think this means I'm going easy on you. If you require healing 3 times a day, I'll just spank all the harder to make up. If need be, I'll go to the strap or the switch. Because I will make your head straight, child. Believe me on that." Those 3 classes, leaving 3 very embarrassed accepted, had another result. Her teaching was shifted to sessions alone with Aes Sedai, something normally reserved for accepted. That meant climbing the long, tapestry-lined, spiraling corridors to the Aja quarters, where sisters stood at the entrances like guards. They were guards, in truth. Visitors from other Ajas were unwelcome, to say the least. In fact, she never saw any Aes Sedai near the quarters of another Aja. Except for sitters, she seldom saw sisters in the hallways outside the quarters other than in groups, always wearing their shawls, usually with warders following close behind. But this was not like the fear that gripped the encampment outside the walls. Here it was always sisters of the same Aja together, and when 2 groups passed, they cut each other dead if they did not glare. In the worst of summer, the tower remained cool, yet the air seemed feverish and gelid when sisters of different Ajas came too close. Even the sitters she recognized walked quickly. The few who realized who she was gave her a long, studying look, but most appeared distracted. Pavara Tazanovni, a plumply pretty sitter for the red, almost walked into her one day. She was not going to jump aside, even for sitters, but Pavara hurried on as if she had not noticed. Another time, Doisine Alwayne, boyishly slim if elegantly dressed, did the same while deep in conversation with another yellow sister. Neither glanced at her twice. She wished she had some idea who the other yellow was. She knew the names of the 10 ferrets Shiriam and the others had sent into the tower to try undermining Elida, and she very much would have liked to make contact with them, but she did not know their faces, and asking after them would only draw attention to them. She hoped one of them would pull her aside or hand her a note, but none did. Her battle would have to be fought alone except for Lyanna, unless she overheard something that put faces to some of those names. She did not neglect Lyanna, of course. Her second night back in the tower, she went down to the open cells after supper despite her bone-deep weariness. Those half-dozen rooms in the first basement were where women who could channel were held, if not to be closely confined. Each held a large cage of iron latticework that ran from stone floor to stone ceiling, with a space around it 4 paces wide and iron stand lamps to provide light. At Lyanna's cell, 2 Browns were sitting on benches against the wall with a warder, a wide-shouldered man with a beautiful face and touches of white at his temples. He looked up when Egwene walked in, then returned to honing his dagger on a stone. One of the Browns was Phelana Bevane, slender with long yellow hair that gleamed as if she brushed it several times a day. She stopped writing in a leather-bound notebook on a lap desk long enough to say in a raspy voice, "Oh, it's you, is it? Well, Sylviana said you can visit, child, but don't give her anything without showing it to Delevian or me, and don't make any fuss." She promptly returned to her writing. Delevian, a stocky woman with gray streaking her short dark hair, never looked up from her comparison of the text of 2 books, one held open on either knee. The glow of Sidar shone around her, and she was maintaining a shield on Lyanna, but there was no reason for her to look once it had been woven. Egwene lost no time in rushing to thrust her hands through the iron latticework and clasp Lyanna's. "Sylviana told me they finally believe who you are," she said, laughing. "But I didn't expect to find you in such luxury." It was luxury only when held up alongside the small, dark cells where a sister might be held for trial, with rushes on the floor for a mattress, and a blanket only if you were lucky. Yet Lyanna's accommodations did appear reasonably comfortable. She had a small bed that looked softer than those in the novice quarters, a ladder-backed chair with a tasseled blue cushion, and a table that held 3 books and a tray with the remains of her supper. There was even a washstand, though the white pitcher and bowl both had chips, and the mirror was bubbled, and a privacy screen, opaque enough that she would be only a shadowy shape behind it, hid the chamber pot. Lyanna laughed, too. "Oh, I am very popular," she said briskly. Even the way she stood seemed languorous, the very image of a seductive Damani despite plain dark woolens, but that brisk voice remained from before she had decided to remake herself as she wanted to be. "I've had a steady stream of visitors all day, from every Aja except the Red. Even the Greens try to convince me to teach them how to travel, and they mainly want to get their hands on me because I claim to be green now." She shivered much too ostentatiously for it to be real. "That would be as bad as being back with Malaire and Dasala. Dreadful woman, Dasala." Her smile faded away like mist in a noonday sun. "They told me they'd put you in white. Better than the alternatives, I suppose. They give you 4 Krut? Me too." Surprised, Egwene glanced toward the sister holding the shield, and Lyanna snorted. "Custom. If I weren't shielded, I could swat a fly and not hurt it. But custom says a woman in the open cells is always shielded. But they just let you wander around otherwise?" "Not exactly," Egwene said dryly. "There are 2 Reds waiting outside to escort me to my room and shield me while I sleep." Lyanna sighed. "So, I'm in a cell, you're being watched, and we're both full of 4 Krut tea." She cast a sidelong look at the 2 Browns. Phelana was still intent on her writing. Delevian turned pages in the 2 books on her knees and began muttering under her breath. The warder must have intended to shave with that dagger, he was honing it so keen. His main attention seemed to be on the doorway, though. Lyanna lowered her voice. "So when do we escape?" "We don't," Egwene told her, and related her reasons and her plan in a near whisper while watching the sisters out of the corner of her eye. She told Lyanna everything she had seen and done. It was hard to tell how many times she had been spanked that day, and how she had behaved during, but necessary to convince the other woman that she would not be broken. I can see any sort of raid is out of the question, but I'd hoped... The warder shifted and Liana cut off, but he was merely sheathing his dagger. Folding his arms across his chest and stretching his legs out, he leaned back against the wall, his eyes on the doorway. He looked as if he could be on his feet in the blink of an eye. "Laris helped me escape once," she went on softly, "but I don't know that she would do it again." She shivered, and there was nothing fake about it this time. She had been stilled when Laris helped her and Swan to escape. She did it for men more than for Swan or me, anyway. "Are you certain about this?" "A hard woman, Sylviana Brehan. Fair, so I hear, but hard enough to break iron." "Are you absolutely certain, Mother?" When Egwene said that she was, Liana sighed again. "Well, we'll be two worms gnawing at the root then, won't we?" It was not a question. She visited Liana every night, that exhaustion failed to drag her to her bed straight after supper, and found her astonishingly sanguine for a prisoner confined to a cell. Liana's stream of visiting sisters was continuing, and she slipped the tidbits Egwene suggested into every conversation. Those visitors could not order an Aes Sedai punished, even one held in the open cells, though a few grew angry enough to wish they could. And besides, hearing those things from a sister carried more weight than hearing them from one they saw as a novice. Liana could even argue openly, at least until the visitors stalked out. But she reported that many did not. A few agreed with her. Cautiously, hesitantly, perhaps on one point and not others, but they agreed. Almost as important, to Liana at least, some of the Greens decided that since she had been stilled and thus was no longer Aes Sedai for a time, she had the right to ask admission to any Aja once she was a sister again. Not all, by any means, but few was better than none. Egwene began to think that Liana in her cell was having more effect than she was roaming free. Well, free after a fashion. She was not exactly jealous. This was important work they were doing, and it did not matter which of them did it better so long as it got done. But there were times when it made the trek to Sylviana's study much harder. Still, she had successes, of a sort. That first afternoon, in Beni Nalsad's cluttered sitting room, books stood in haphazard stacks everywhere on the floor tiles, and the shelves were full of bones and skulls and the preserved skins of animals, birds, and snakes, along with stuffed examples of some of the smaller specimens. A large brown lizard was perched on the huge skull of a bear, so still you would have thought it stuffed as well, until it blinked. That first afternoon the Shinaran Brown asked her to perform an exhaustive set of weaves one after the other. Beni sat in a high-backed chair on one side of the brown-streaked marble fireplace, she, with decided discomfort, in one on the other. She had not been invited to sit, but neither had Beni objected. Egwene performed each weave as asked until Beni casually asked for the weave for traveling, and then she merely smiled and folded her hands in her lap. The sister leaned back and adjusted her deep brown silk skirts a hair. Beni's eyes were blue and sharp, her dark hair caught in a silver net liberally streaked with gray. Ink stains marked two of her fingers and another smudged the side of her nose. She held a porcelain cup of tea, but she had not offered any to Egwene. "I think there is little of the power that remains for you to learn, child, especially considering your wonderful discoveries." Egwene inclined her head, accepting the compliment. Some of those things truly were her discoveries, and it hardly mattered now in any case. "But that hardly means you have nothing to learn. You had few novice classes before you were..." The Brown frowned at Egwene's white dress and cleared her throat. "And fewer lessons as... well, later. Tell me, if you can, what mistakes did Shine Chunla make that caused the Third War of Garen's Wall? What were the causes of the Great Winter War between Andor and Kyrian? What caused the Wyken Rebellion and how did it end? Most of history seems to be the study of wars, and the important parts of that are how and why they began and how and why ended. A great many wars would never have taken place if people had paid attention to the mistakes others had made. Well, Shine didn't make any mistakes, Egwene said slowly. But you're right, I do have a lot to learn. I don't even know the names of those other wars. Rising, she poured herself a cup of tea from the silver pitcher on the side table. Aside from the ropework silver tray, the tabletop held a stuffed lynx and the skull of a serpent. That was as big as a man's skull. Benai frowned, but not for the tea. She hardly seemed to notice that. What do you mean Shine didn't make any mistakes, child? Why, she bungled the situation as badly as ever I've heard of. Well before the Third War of Garen's Wall, Egwene said, returning to her chair, Shine was doing exactly as the Hall told her, and nothing they didn't. She might be lacking in other areas of history, but Swan had tutored her thoroughly in the mistakes made by other Amerlans, and this particular question gave her an opening. Sitting down normally took a great effort. What are you talking about? She tried running the tower with an iron hand, never a compromise on anything, running roughshod over any opposition. The Hall grew tired of it, but they couldn't settle on a replacement. So rather than deposing her, they did worse. They left her in place and forced a penance on her whenever she tried to issue an order of any kind. Any kind at all. She knew she was going on, sounding as if she were the one giving a lecture, but she had to get it all out. Not easing herself on the hard wood of the chair seat was difficult. Welcome the pain. The Hall ran Shine and the tower, but they mishandled a great deal themselves, largely because each Aja had its own goals and there was no hand to shape them into a goal for the tower. Shine's reign was marked by wars all over the map. Eventually, the sisters themselves got tired of the Hall's bungling. In one of the six mutinies in tower history, Shine and the Hall were pulled down. I know she supposedly died in the Tower of Natural Causes, but in fact she was smothered in her bed in exile 51 years later after the discovery of a plot to put her back on the Amerlin seat.
Mutinies? Benai said incredulously. Six of them? Exiled and smothered?
It's all recorded in the secret histories, in the 13th depository. Though I suppose I shouldn't have told you that. Egwene took a sip of tea and grimaced. It was all but rancid. No wonder Benai had not touched hers.
Secret histories? A 13th depository? If such a thing existed, and I think I would know, why should you not have told me?
Because, by law, the existence of the secret histories as well as their contents can be known only to the Amerlin, the Keeper, and the Sitters. Them and the librarians who keep the records, anyway. Even the law itself is part of the 13th depository, so I guess I shouldn't have told that either. But if you can gain access somehow, or ask someone who knows and will tell you, you'll find out I'm right. Six times in the history of the Tower when the Amerlin was dangerously divisive or dangerously incompetent, and the Hall failed to act, sisters have risen up to remove her.
There.
She could not have planted the seed deeper with a shovel, or driven it home more bluntly with a hammer. Benai stared at her for a long moment, then raised the cup to her lips. She spluttered as soon as the tea touched her tongue and began dabbing at the spots on her dress with a delicate lace-edged handkerchief.
"The Great Winter War," she said huskily as she set the cup on the floor beside her chair. "Began late in the year 671.
She did not mention secret records or mutinies again, but she did not have to. More than once during the lesson, she trailed off, frowning at something beyond Egwene, and Egwene had little doubt what it was. Later that day, Lirene Dwarellin said,
"Yes, Elida made a vital mistake there," pacing up and down in front of her sitting room's fireplace.
The Kyrianan sister was only a little shorter than Egwene, but the nervous way her eyes darted gave her the air of a hunted thing, a sparrow fearful of cats, and convinced there were lots of cats in the vicinity. Her dark green skirts had only four discreet slashes of red, though she had been a sitter once.
That proclamation of hers on top of trying to kidnap him could not have been better calculated to keep the Al-Thor boy as far from the tower as he can stay. Oh, she has made mistakes, Elida has.
Egwene wanted to ask about Rand and kidnapping,
kidnapping. But Lyrine left no opening as she went on about Elida's many mistakes, all the while pacing back and forth, her eyes darting and her hands twisting unconsciously. Egwene was unsure whether or not that session could be called a success, but at least it was not a failure, and she had learned something. Not all of her forays went so well, of course.
"This is not a discussion," Pritella Nurbijan said. Her tone was utterly calm, yet her tilted green eyes were heated. Her room looked more those of a green than a yellow, with several bared swords hanging on the walls and a silk tapestry showing men fighting Trollocs. She was gripping the hilt of the dagger at her woven silver belt. Not a simple belt knife. A dagger with a blade near a foot long and an emerald capping its pommel. Why she had agreed to lecture Egwene was a mystery given her dislike of teaching. Perhaps because it was Egwene.
"You are here for a lesson on the limits of power. A very basic lesson, suitable for a novice."
Egwene wanted to shift on the three-legged stool that Pritella had given her for a seat, but instead she concentrated on the smarting, focused on drinking it in, on welcoming it. The day had already seen three visits to Sylviana, and she could sense a fourth coming, with the midday meal an hour off yet.
"I merely said that if Shemarin could be reduced from Aes Sedai to accepted, then Elida's power has no limits. At least she thinks it doesn't. But if you accept that, then it really doesn't."
Pritella's grip tightened on the dagger's hilt until her knuckles showed white, yet she seemed unaware.
"Since you think you know better than I," she said coolly, "you can visit Sylviana when we finish."
A partial success, perhaps. Egwene did not think Pritella's anger was for her.
"I expect proper behavior out of you," Sarantia Colvine told her firmly another day. The word to describe the Grey Sister was pinched. A pinched mouth and a pinched nose that constantly seemed to be detecting a bad smell. Even her pale blue eyes seemed pinched with disapproval. She might well have been pretty otherwise. "Do you understand?"
"I understand," Egwene said, sitting down on the stool that had been placed in front of Sarantia's high-backed chair. The morning was cool, and a small fire burned on the stone hearth. "Drink in the pain. Welcome the pain."
"An incorrect response," Sarantia said. "The correct response would have been a curtsy and, 'I understand, Sarantia Sedai. I intend to make a list of your failures for you to carry to Sylviana when we're done. We'll begin again. Do you understand, child?"
"I understand," Egwene said, without rising. Aes Sedai Serenity or no Aes Sedai Serenity, Sarantia's face turned purple. In the end, her list covered 4 pages in a tight, cramped hand. She spent more time writing than she did lecturing. Not a success.
And then there was Adelorna Bastine.
The Saldaean green somehow managed stateliness in spite of being slim and no taller than Egwene, and she had a regal, commanding air that might have been intimidating had Egwene let it.
"I hear you make trouble," she said, picking up an ivory-backed hairbrush from a small inlaid table beside her chair. "If you try to make trouble with me, you'll learn that I know how to use this."
Egwene did learn, without trying. 3 times she went across Adelorna's lap, and the woman did indeed know how to use a hairbrush for more than brushing her hair. That managed to stretch an hour lecture to 2.
"May I go now?" Egwene said at last, calmly drying her cheeks as well as she could with a handkerchief that was already damp. "Breathe in the pain. Absorb the fire. I'm supposed to fetch water up for the red, and I don't want to be late."
Adelorna frowned at her hairbrush before returning it to the table that Egwene had overset 2 times with her kicking. Then she frowned at Egwene, studying her as if trying to see inside her skull.
"I wish Cadswain were in the tower," she murmured. "I think she'd find you a challenge."
There seemed a touch of respect in her voice. That day was a turning point in some ways. For one thing, Sylviana decided that Egwene was to receive healing 2 times each day.
"You seem to invite being beaten, child.
It's pure stubbornness, and I won't put up with it. You will face reality. The next time you visit me, we'll see how you like the strap."
The Mistress of Novices folded Egwene's shift over her back, then paused.
"Are you smiling? Did I say something amusing?"
"I just thought of something funny," Egwene said. "Nothing of consequence."
Not of consequence to Sylviana, anyway. She had realized how to welcome the pain. She was fighting a war, not a single battle, and every time she was beaten, every time she was sent to Sylviana, it was a sign that she had fought another battle and refused to yield. The pain was a badge of honor. She howled and kicked as hard as ever during that slippering, but while she was drying her cheeks afterward, she hummed quietly to herself. It was easy to welcome a badge of honor. Attitudes among the novices began to shift by the second day of her captivity. It seemed that Nicola and Arena, who was working in the stables and often came to visit Nicola, they seemed so close that Egwene wondered whether they had become pillow friends, always with their heads together and smiling mysterious smiles. Nicola and Arena had regaled them all with tales of her. Very inflated tales. The two women had made her seem a combination of every legendary sister in the histories, along with Birgitta Silverbow and Amaresu herself, carrying the Sword of the Sun into battle. Half of them seemed in awe of her, the others angry with her for some reason, or outright scornful. Foolishly, some tried to emulate her behavior in their classes, but a flurry of visits to Sylviana quelled that. At the midday meal of the third day, nearly 24 novices ate standing up and red-faced with embarrassment, Nicola among them, and Alvestir, surprisingly. That number dropped to 7 at supper, and on the fourth day only Nicola and the Kyrianan girl did so, and that was the end of that. She expected some might resent the fact that she continued to refuse to bend while they had been put back on the straight and narrow so quickly, but to the contrary, it only seemed to decrease the number who were angry or scornful and increase the respect. No one tried to become her friend, which was just as well. White dress or no white dress, she was Aes Sedai, and it was improper for an Aes Sedai to befriend a novice. There was too much risk the girl would start feeling above herself and get into trouble for it. Novices began coming to her for advice, for help learning their lessons, though. Only a handful at first, but the number grew day by day. She was willing to help them learn, which was usually just a matter of strengthening a girl's confidence, or convincing a young woman that caution was wise, or taking them patiently through the steps of a weave that was giving trouble. Novices were forbidden to channel without an Aes Sedai or accepted present, though they nearly always did in secret anyway. But she was a sister. She refused to help more than one at a time, however. Word of groups would surely leak out, and she would not be the only one sent to Sylviana. She would make that trip as often as necessary, but she did not want to earn it for others. And as for advice, with the novices kept strictly clear of men, advice was easy, though strains between pillow friends could be as harsh as anything men ever caused. One evening, returning from yet another session with Sylviana, she overheard Nicola talking to two novices who could not have been more than 15 or 16. Egwene hardly remembered being that young. It seemed a lifetime ago. Mara was a stocky Murandian with mischievous blue eyes, Nameen a tall, slim Damani who giggled incessantly. "Ask the mother," Nicola said. A few of the novices had taken to calling Egwene that, though never were anyone not wearing white could hear. They were foolish, but not utter fools. "She's always willing to give advice." Nameen giggled nervously and wriggled. "I wouldn't want to bother her."
"Besides," Mara said, a lilt in her voice, "they say she always gives the same advice she does."
"And good advice it is, too." Nicola held up one hand to tick off fingers. "Obey the Aes Sedai. Obey the accepted. Work hard. Then work harder."
Gliding on toward her room, Egwene smiled. She had been unable to make Nicola behave properly while she was openly Amarlin, but it seemed she might have succeeded while masquerading as a novice herself. Remarkable. There was one more thing she could do for them. Comfort them. Impossible as it seemed at first, the interior of the tower sometimes changed. People got lost, trying to find rooms they had been to dozens of times. Women were seen walking out of walls or into them, often in dresses of old-fashioned cut, sometimes in bizarre garb, dresses that seemed simply lengths of brightly colored cloth folded around the body, embroidered ankle-length tabards worn over wide trousers, stranger things still. Light! When could any woman have wanted to wear a dress that left her bosom completely exposed? Egwene was able to discuss it with Swan in Telairun Riod, so she knew that these things were signs of the approach of Tarman Gaiden. An unpleasant thought, yet there was nothing to be done about it. What was, and it was not as if Rand himself was not a herald of the last battle. Some of the sisters in the tower must have known what it all meant, too, but wrapped up in their own affairs, they made no effort to comfort novices who were weeping with fright. Egwene did. "The world is full of strange wonders," she told Corrida, a pale-haired girl who was sobbing face down on her bed. Only a year younger than herself, Corrida was most definitely still a girl, despite a year and a half in the tower. "Why be surprised if some of those wonders appear in the White Tower? What better place?" She never mentioned the last battle to these girls. That was hardly likely to be any comfort.
"But she walked into a wall," Corrida wailed, raising her head.
Her face was red and blotchy, and her cheeks glistened damply.
"A wall! And then none of us could find the classroom, and Pedra couldn't either, and she got cross with us. Pedra never gets cross. She was frightened, too."
"I'll wager Pedra didn't start crying, though." Egwene sat down on the edge of the girl's bed and was pleased that she did not wince. Novice mattresses were not noted for softness. "The dead can't harm the living, Corrida. They can't touch us. They don't even seem to see us. Besides, they were initiates of the tower or else servants here. This was their home as much as it is ours. And as for rooms or hallways not being where they're supposed to be, just remember that the tower is a place of wonders. Remember that, and they won't frighten you." It seemed feeble to her, but Corrida wiped her eyes and swore she would never be frightened again. Unfortunately, there were 102 like her, not all so easily comforted. It was enough to make Egwene angrier at the sisters in the tower than she already had been. Her days were not all lessons and comforting novices and being punished by the mistress of novices, though the last did take up an unfortunate amount of each day. Sylviana had been right to doubt that she would have much free time. Novices were always given chores. Often it was make-work, since the tower had well over 1,000 serving men and women without counting laborers. But physical work helped build character, so the tower had always believed. Plus it helped keep the novices too tired to think of men, supposedly. She was loaded down with chores beyond what the novices were given, though. Some were assigned by sisters who considered her a runaway, others by Sylviana in the hope that weariness would dull the edge of her rebellion. Daily, after one meal or another, she scrubbed dirty pots with coarse salt and a stiff brush in the workroom off the main kitchen. From time to time, Laris would put her head in, but she never spoke. And she never used her long spoon, even when Egwene was massaging the small of her back, aching from being head down in a large kettle rather than scrubbing. Laris dealt out smacks aplenty to scullions and undercooks who tried to play pranks on Egwene, as was customary with novices sent to work in the kitchen. Supposedly that was just because, as she announced loudly every time she gave a thwack, they had plenty of time to play when they were not supposed to be working, but Egwene noticed that Laris was not so quick when someone goosed one of the true novices or tipped a cup of cold water down the back of her neck. It seemed she did have an ally of sorts, if she could only figure out how to make use of her. She hauled water in buckets hanging from the ends of a pole balanced across her shoulders to the kitchen, to the novices' quarters, to the accepted's quarters, all the way up to the Aja quarters. She carried meals to sisters in their rooms, raked garden paths, pulled weeds, ran errands for sisters, attended sitters, swept floors, mopped floors, scrubbed floors on her hands and knees, and that was only a partial list. She never shirked at these tasks, and only in part because she would not give anyone an excuse to call her lazy. In a way, she viewed them as penance for not having prepared properly before turning the harbor chain to Quendiyar. Penances were to be borne with dignity, as much dignity as anyone can have while scrubbing a floor, anyway. Besides, visiting the Accepted's quarters gave her a chance to see how they viewed her. There were 31 in the tower, but at any given time some were teaching novices and others taking lessons of their own, so she seldom found more than 10 or 12 in their rooms, around the 9-tiered well surrounding a small garden. Word of her arrival always spread quickly, though, and she never lacked an audience. At first, many of them tried to overwhelm her with orders, especially Mare, a plump blue-eyed Arafelin, and Asael, a slim Terrabonner with pale hair and brown eyes. They had been novices when she came to the tower, and already jealous of her quick rise to Accepted when she left. With them, every second sentence was fetch that or carry this there. For all of them, she was the novice who had caused so much difficulty, the novice who thought she was the Amerlin seat. She carried pails of water till her back ached, uncomplaining, yet she refused to obey their commands, which earned her more visits to the Mistress of Novices, of course. As the days passed, as her continual trips to Sylviana's study showed no effect, however, that flow of commands dwindled and finally ceased. Even Asael and Mare had not really been trying to be mean, only to behave as they thought they should in the circumstances, and they were at a loss as to what to do with her. Some of the Accepted showed signs of fright at the dead walking and the interior of the tower changing, and whenever she saw a bloodless face or teary eyes, she would say the same things she told the novices. Not addressing the woman directly, which might have gotten her back up rather than soothing her, but as if talking to herself. It worked as well with Accepted as with novices. Many gave a start when she began, or opened their mouths as though to tell her to be quiet, yet none did, and she always left a thoughtful expression behind. The Accepted continued to come out onto the stone-railed galleries when she entered, but they watched her in silence as though wondering what she was. Eventually she would teach them what she was. Them and the sisters, too. Attending sitters and sisters, a woman in white standing quietly in the corner quickly became part of the furniture, even when she was notorious. If they noticed her, they changed their conversation, yet she overheard many snippets, often of plots to avenge some slight given or wrong done by another Aja. Oddly, most of the sisters seemed to see the other Ajas inside the tower as more their enemies than they did the sisters in the camp outside the city, and the sitters were not much better. It made her want to slap them. True, it boded well for relations when the other sisters returned to the tower, but still. She did pick up other things. The unbelievable disaster that had befallen an expedition sent against the Black Tower. Some of the sisters seemed not to believe it, yet they appeared to be trying to convince themselves it could not have happened. More sisters captured after a great battle and somehow forced to swear fealty to Rand. She had already had inklings of that, and she could not like it any more than she did sisters being bonded by Ashaman. Being Taviran or the Dragon Reborn was no excuse. No Aes Sedai had ever before sworn fealty to any man. The sisters and sitters argued over who was to blame, with Rand and the Ashaman at the head of the list. But one name came up again and again, Elida Doavrinia Royhan. They talked of Rand, too, of how to find him before Tarman Gaiden. They knew it was coming, despite their failure to console the novices and Accepted, and they were desperate to lay hands on him. Sometimes she risked a comment, a mention of Shemeran being stripped of the shawl against all custom, a suggestion that Elida's edict regarding Rand was the best way in the world to make him dig in his heels. She offered sympathy for the sisters captured by the Ashaman, for those taken at Dumai's Wells, with Elida's name dropped in, or regretted the neglect that saw garbage rotting in the once pristine streets of Tar Valon. There was no need to mention Elida there. They knew who was responsible for Tar Valon. At times, those comments earned her still more trips to Sylviana's study, and more chores besides, yet surprisingly often they did not. She made careful note of the sisters who merely told her to be quiet, or better still, said nothing. Some even nodded agreement before they caught themselves. Some of those chores led to interesting encounters. On the morning of her second day, she was using a long-handled bamboo rake to fish detritus from the ponds of the water garden. There had been a rainstorm the night before, and the heavy winds had deposited leaves and grasses in the ponds among the bright green lily pads and budding water irises, and even a dead sparrow that she calmly buried in one of the flower beds. A pair of reds stood on one of the arching pond bridges, leaning on the lacy stone railing and watching her, and the fish swirling below them in a flurry of red and gold and white. A half-dozen crows burst up out of one of the leather leaves and silently winged their way north. Crows? The tower grounds were supposed to be warded against crows and ravens. The reds did not seem to have noticed. She was squatting on her heels beside one of the ponds, washing the dirt from her hands after burying that pitiful bird, when Alviarin appeared, her white-fringed shawl wrapped tightly around her, as if the morning were still windy rather than bright and fair. This was the third time she had seen Alviarin, and every time she had been alone rather than in company with other whites. She had seen clusters of whites in the hallways, though. Was there a clue in that? If so, she could not imagine to what, unless Alviarin was being shunned by her own Aja for some reason. Surely the rot had not gone that deep. Eyeing the reds, Alviarin approached Egwene along the coarse gravel path that wound among the ponds. "You have fallen far," she said when she was close. "You must feel it keenly." Egwene straightened and blotted her hands on her skirt, then picked up the rake. "I'm not the only one." She had had another session with Sylviana before dawn, and when she left the woman's study, Alviarin had been waiting to go in again. That was a daily ritual for the white, and the talk of the novices' quarters, with every tongue speculating on the why of it. "My mother always says, don't weep over what can't be mended. It seems good advice under the circumstances." Faint spots of color appeared in Alviarin's cheeks. "But you seem to be weeping a good deal. Endlessly, by all reports. Surely you would escape that if you could." Egwene caught another oak leaf on the broom and brushed it off into the wooden pail of damp leaves at her feet. "Your loyalty to Elida isn't very strong, is it?" "Why do you say that?" Alviarin said suspiciously. Glancing at the two reds, who appeared to be paying more mind now to the fish than Egwene, she stepped closer, inviting lowered voices. Egwene fished at a long strand of grass that had to have come all the way from the plains beyond the river. Should she mention the letter this woman had written to Rand, practically promising him the White Tower at his feet? No. That piece of information might prove valuable, but it seemed the sort of thing that could only be used once. "She stripped you of the Keeper's stole and ordered your penance. That's hardly an inducement to loyalty." Alviarin's face remained smooth, yet her shoulders relaxed visibly. Aes Sedai seldom showed so much. She must feel under phenomenal strain to be so little in control of herself. She darted a look at the reds again. "Think on your situation," she said in near a whisper. "If you want an escape from it, well, you may be able to find one." "I am content with my situation," Egwene said simply. Alviarin's eyebrows quirked upwards in disbelief, but with another glance at the reds, one was watching them now rather than the fish, she glided away, a very fast glide, on the verge of breaking into a trot. Every 2 or 3 days she would appear while Egwene was doing chores, and while she never openly offered help with an escape, she used that word frequently, and she began to show frustration when Egwene refused to rise to her bait. Bait it was, to be sure. Egwene did not trust the woman. Perhaps it was that letter, surely designed to draw Rand to the tower and into Elida's clutches. Or maybe it was the way she kept waiting for Egwene to make the first move, to beg, possibly. Likely Alviarin would try to set conditions then. In any case, she had no intention of escaping unless there was no other choice, so she always gave the same response. "I am content with my situation." Alviarin began grinding her teeth audibly when she heard that. On the fourth day, she was on her hands and knees, scrubbing blue and white floor tiles, when the boots of three men, accompanied by a sister in elaborately red-embroidered gray silk, passed her. A few paces on, the boots stopped.
"That be her," a man's voice said in the accents of Ilion. "She did be pointed out to me. I think me I will speak to her."
"She's only another novice, Matin Stepanaeus," the sister told him. "You wanted to walk in the gardens." Egwene dipped her scrub brush in the bucket of soapy water and began another stretch of tiles.
"Fortune, stab me, Cariandra. This may be the White Tower, but I do still be the lawful king of Ilion, and if I want to speak to her, with you for chaperone, all very proper and decent, then I will speak with her. I did be told she did grow up in the same village with Althor."
One set of boots, blacked till they glistened, approached Egwene. Only then did she stand, the dripping brush in one hand. She used the back of the other to brush her hair out of her face. She refrained from knuckling the small of her back, much as she wanted to. Matin Stepanaeus was stocky and almost entirely bald, with a neatly trimmed white beard in the Ilioner fashion and a heavily creased face. His eyes were sharp and angry. Armor would have suited him better than the green silk coat embroidered with golden bees on the sleeves and lapels.
"Just another novice," he murmured. "I think you be mistaken, Cariandra."
The plump red, her lips compressed, left the two serving men with the flame of Tarvalin on their chests and joined the balding man. Her disapproving gaze touched Egwene briefly before shifting to him. "She's a much-punished novice who has a floor to scrub. Come, the gardens should be very pleasant this morning."
"What be pleasant," he said. "Do be talking to someone other than Aes Sedai, and only of the Red Aja at that, since you do manage to keep me from any others. On top of which, the servants you did give me might as well be mutes, and I think me the tower guards do have orders to hold their tongues around me as well."
He fell silent as two more red sisters approached. Nasita, plump and blue-eyed and mean as a snake with the itch, nodded companionably to Cariandra, while Barrasine handed Egwene the by now all too familiar pewter cup. The red seemed to have custody of her in a way, at least her watchers and minders were always reds, and they seldom let much more than the promised hour pass before someone appeared with the cup of forkroot tea. She drained it and handed it back. Nasita seemed disappointed that she did not protest or refuse, but there seemed little point. She had once, and Nasita had helped pour the vile stuff down her throat using a funnel she had ready in her belt pouch. That would have been a fine show of dignity in front of Matin Stepanaeus. He watched the silent exchange with puzzled interest, though Cariandra plucked at his sleeve, urging him again to his walk in the gardens.
"Sisters, bring you water when you thirst?" he asked when Barrasine and Nasita glided away.
"A tea they think will improve my mood," she told him. "You look well, Matin Stepanaeus, for a man Elida had kidnapped." That tale was the talk of the novices' quarters, too. Cariandra hissed and opened her mouth, but he spoke up first, his jaw tight.
"Elida did save me from murder by Althor," he said.
The red nodded approvingly. "Why would you think yourself in danger from him?" Egwene asked. The man grunted.
"He did murder Morghaes in Camelin, and Colaver in Cairion. He destroyed half the Sun Palace, killing her, I did hear. And I did hear of Tyran Highlords poisoned or stabbed to death in Cairion. Who can say what other rulers he did murder and destroy the bodies?"
Cariandra nodded again, smiling. You might have thought him a boy reciting his lessons. Did the woman have no understanding of men? He certainly saw it. His jaw grew harder still, and his hands clenched into fists for a moment. "Colaver hanged herself," Egwene said, making sure she sounded patient. "The Sun Palace was damaged later by someone trying to kill the Dragon Reborn, maybe the Forsaken, and according to Elaine Trakand, her mother was murdered by Ravine. Rand has announced his support for her claims to both the Lion Throne and the Sun Throne. He hasn't killed any of the Kyrianna nobles rebelling against him, or the High Lords in rebellion. In fact, he named one of them his steward in Tyr." "I think that is quite," Cariandra began, pulling her shawl up onto her shoulders, but Egwene went on right over her. "Any sister could have told you all that, if she wanted to, if they were speaking to one another. Think why you see only red sisters.
Have you seen sisters of any two Ajahs speaking? You've been kidnapped and brought aboard a sinking ship. That is more than enough, Kariandra snapped, right atop Egwene's last sentence. When you finish scrubbing this floor, you will run to the Mistress of Novices and ask her to punish you for shirking, and for showing disrespect to an Aes Sedai. Egwene met the woman's furious gaze calmly. I have barely enough time after I finish to get clean before my lesson with Kiyoshi. Could I visit Sylviana after the lesson? Kariandra shifted her shawl, seemingly taken aback by her calmness. That is a problem for you to work out, she said at last. Come, Matin Stepanaeus, you have helped this child shirk long enough. There was no time to change out of her damp dress or even comb her hair after leaving Sylviana's study, not if she were to have any hope of being on time for Kiyoshi without running, which she refused to do. That made her late, and it turned out that the tall, slender Grey was a stickler for both punctuality and neatness, which put her back yelping and kicking under Sylviana's hard-swung strap little more than an hour later. Quite aside from embracing pain, something else helped see her through that. The memory of Matin Stepanaeus's thoughtful expression as Kariandra led him off down the corridor, and how he twice looked back over his shoulder at her. She had planted another seed. Enough seeds planted, and perhaps what sprouted from them would splinter those cracks in the platform beneath Elida. Enough seeds would bring Elida down. Early on her seventh day of captivity, she was carrying water up the tower again, to the White Aja quarters this time, when she suddenly stopped in her tracks, feeling as if she had been punched in her stomach hard. Two women in grey-fringed shawls were walking down the spiraling corridor toward her, trailed by a pair of warders. One was Melavere Somenelin, a stout Kyrianin in fine grey wool with white flecking her dark hair. The other, with blue eyes and dark honey hair, was Baenin. "So you're the one who betrayed me," Egwene said angrily. A thought occurred to her. How could Baenin have betrayed her after swearing fealty? "You must be Black Aja." Melavere drew herself up as much as she could, which was not very far, since she was inches shorter than Egwene, and planted her fists on her ample hips as she opened her mouth to deliver a blast. Egwene had had one lesson from her, and while she was a kindly woman usually, when she became angry, she could be fearsome. Baenin laid a hand on the other sister's plump arm. "Let me speak to her alone, please, Melavere." "I trust you will speak sharply," Melavere said in a stiff voice. "To even think of making such a charge, to even mention some things." Shaking her head in disgust, she retreated a little up the corridor, followed by her warder, squat and even wider than she, a bear of a man, though he moved with the expected warder grace. Baenin gestured and waited until her own warder, a lean man with a long scar on his face, joined them. She adjusted her shawl several times. "Me, I betrayed nothing," she said quietly. "I would not have sworn to you except that the hall, it would have had me birched if it learned the secrets you knew. Perhaps more than once, even. Reason enough to swear, no? I never pretended to love you, yet I maintained that oath until you were captured. But you are no longer Amerlin, yes? Not as a captive, not when there was no hope of rescuing you, when you refused rescue. And you are a novice once more. So that oath, it has two reasons to hold no longer. The talk of rebellion, it was wild talk. The rebellion is finished. The White Tower, it will soon be whole again, and I will not be sorry to see it so." Lifting the pole from her shoulders, Egwene set down the pails of water and folded her arms beneath her breasts. She had tried to maintain a calm demeanor since being captured, well, except when she was being punished, but this encounter would have tried a stone. "You explain yourself at great length," she said dryly. "Are you trying to convince yourself? It won't do, Baenin. It won't do. If the rebellion is finished, where is the flood of sisters coming to kneel before Elida and accept her penance? Light, what else have you betrayed? Everything?" It seemed likely. She had visited Elida's study a number of times in Telairun Riod, but the woman's correspondence box had always been empty. Now she knew why. Sharp spots of red appeared in Bayonin's cheeks.
I tell you, I have betrayed n-.
She finished with a strangled grunt and put a hand to her throat as it refused to let the lie leave her tongue. That proved she was not Black Aja, but it proved something more.
You betrayed the ferrets.
Are they all down in the basement cells? Bayonin's eyes flashed up the corridor. Melavere was talking with her warder, his head bent close to hers. Squat or not, he was taller than she. Bayonin's Tervail was watching her with a worried expression. The distance was too far for any of the three to have overheard, but Bayonin stepped closer and lowered her voice.
Elida, she is having them watched, though I think the Ajas, they keep what they see to themselves. Few sisters want to tell Elida any more than they must. It was necessary, you understand. I could hardly return to the tower and keep them secret. It would have been discovered eventually.
Then you'll have to warn them. Egwene could not keep her voice clear of her disdain. This woman split hairs with a razor. She took the thinnest excuse to decide her oath no longer applied, and then she betrayed the very women she had helped choose. Blood and bloody ashes.
Bayonin remained silent for a long moment, fiddling with her shawl, but at last she said, surprisingly, I have already warned Maidani and Jennet. They were the two greys among the ferrets. I have done what I can for them. The others, they must sink or swim by themselves. Sisters have been assaulted for simply going too near another Aja's quarters. Me, I will not walk back to my rooms, clad only in my shawl and the welts, just to try.
Think of it as a penance, Egwene cut in.
Light! Sisters assaulted! Things were even worse than she had thought.
She had to remind herself that well-manured ground would help her seeds to grow.
Bayonin glanced up the hallway again, and Tervail took a step toward her before Bayonin shook her head. Her face was smooth, despite the color staining her cheeks, but inside she must have been in turmoil.
You know I could send you to the Mistress of Novices, yes? She said in a tight voice. I hear you spend half of each day squealing for her. I think you would dislike more visits, yes?
Egwene smiled at her. Not 2 hours earlier she had managed to smile the moment Sylviana's strap stopped falling. This was much harder.
And who can say what I might squeal? About oaths, perhaps?
The color drained from the other woman's cheeks, leaving her face bloodless pale. No, she did not want that getting out.
You may have convinced yourself I am no longer Amarlin, Bayonin, but it's time to start convincing yourself that I still am. You will warn the others, whatever the cost to yourself. Tell them to stay away from me unless I send word otherwise. They've had more than enough attention drawn to them. But from now on, you'll seek me out every day in case I have instructions for them. I have some now.
Quickly, she listed the things she wanted them to bring up in conversation, Shemarin being stripped of the shawl, Elida's complicity in the disasters at the Black Tower and Dumai's Wells, all the seeds she had been planting. They would not be planted one by one now, but broadcast by handfuls.
Me, I cannot speak for other Ajas, Bayonin said when she finished. But in the Grey, sisters speak of most of these things often. The eyes and ears, they are busy of late. Secrets Elida hoped to hold, they are coming out. I am sure it must be the same in the others. Perhaps it is not necessary for me to warn them and deliver my instructions, Bayonin.
Egwene lifted the pole back onto her shoulders, shifting it to the most comfortable position she could find. Two or three of the whites would use a hairbrush or slipper on her and send her to Sylviana if they thought her slow. Embracing pain, even welcoming it, did not mean seeking it out unnecessarily.
Remember, it's a penance I've set you.
I will do as you say, Bayonin said with obvious reluctance. Her eyes hardened suddenly, but it was not for Egwene.
It would be enjoyable to see Elida pulled down, she said in an unpleasant voice, before hurrying away to join Melavere.
That shocking meeting, turned into an unexpected victory, left Egwene feeling very good about the day. And no matter that Farana did turn out to think she had been slow. The white sitter was plump,
but she had an arm as strong as Sylviana's. That night she dragged herself down to the open cells after supper, despite wanting her bed in the worst way. Aside from lessons and howling under Sylviana's strap, the last time just before supper, most of the rest of the day had been given to hauling water. Her back and shoulders ached. Her arms ached. Her legs. She was swaying on her feet with weariness. Strangely, she had not had one of those wretched headaches since being taken prisoner, nor any of those dark dreams that left her disturbed, even though she could never remember them. But she thought she might be heading for a fine headache tonight. That would make telling true dreams difficult, and she had had some fine ones lately, about Rand, Matt, Perrin, even Gawain, though most dreams of him were just that. Three white sisters she knew in passing were guarding Lyanna. Nagora, a lean woman with pale hair worn in a roll on her nape, who sat very straight to make up for her lack of stature. Noreen, lovely with her large liquid eyes, but often as vague as any brown. And Miyasi, tall and plump, with iron-gray hair, a stern woman who brooked no nonsense and saw nonsense everywhere. Nagora, surrounded by the light of Sidar, held the shield on Lyanna, but they were arguing over some point of logic that Egwene could not make out from the little she heard. She could not even tell whether there were two sides to the argument or three. There were no raised voices, no shaken fists, and their faces remained smooth Aes Sedai masks, but the coldness in their voices left no doubt that had they not been Aes Sedai, they would have been shouting, if not trading blows. She might as well not have existed for all the attention they paid her entrance. Watching the three from the edge of her eye, she moved as close to the iron latticework as she could and gripped it with both hands to steady herself. Light, she was tired. "I saw Beanin today," she said softly. "She's here in the tower. She claimed her oath to me no longer held because I was no longer the Ammerlin seat." Lyanna gasped and stepped near enough that she was brushing the iron bars. "She betrayed us?" "The inherent impossibility of dissimulated structures is a given," Nagora said firmly. Her voice was an icy hammer. "A given."
"She denies it, and I believe her," Egwene whispered. "But she admitted betraying the ferrets. Elida is only having them watched for the moment, but I told Beanin to warn them, and she said she would. She said she'd already warned Maedani and Jennet, but why would she betray them and then tell them about it? And she said she would like to see Elida pulled down. Why would she flee to Elida if she still wants her brought down? She has much admitted no one else has abandoned our cause. I'm missing something, and I'm too tired to see what it is."
A yawn that she barely managed to cover with a hand cracked her jaw. "Dissimulated structures are implied by four of the five axioms of sixth-order rationality," Miyasi said just as firmly. "Strongly implied."
"So-called sixth-order rationality has been discarded as an aberration by anyone with intellect," Noreen put in, a touch sharply. "But dissimulated structures are fundamental to any possibility of understanding what is happening right here in the tower every day. Reality itself is shifting, changing day by day."
Lyanna glanced at the whites.
"Some always thought Elida had spies among us. If Beanin was one, her oath to you would have held her until she could convince herself you were no longer Ammerlin. But if her reception here wasn't what she expected, it might have changed her loyalties. Beanin was always ambitious. If she didn't get her due as she sees matters," she spread her hands. "Beanin always expected her due, and perhaps a little more."
"Logic is always applicable to the real world," Miyasi said dismissively. "But only a novice would think the real world can be applied to logic. Ideals must be first principles, not the mundane world."
Nagora snapped her mouth shut with a dark look, as if she felt words had been snatched right off her tongue.
Coloring faintly, Noreen rose and glided away from the benches toward Egwene. The other two followed her with their eyes, and she seemed to feel their gazes, shifting her shawl uncomfortably first one way, then another.
"Child, you look exhausted. Go to your bed now." Egwene wanted nothing more than her bed, but she had a question to be answered first. Only she had to be careful. The three whites were all paying attention now,
Liana, do you think the sisters who visit you still ask the same questions?
I told you to go to your bed, Noreen said sharply. She clapped her hands together as if that would somehow make Egwene obey.
Yes, Liana said. I see what you mean. Perhaps there can be a measure of trust.
A small measure, Egwene said. Noreen planted her fists on her hips. There was little coolness in her face or her voice, and no vagueness at all about her.
Since you refuse to go to your bed, you can go to the Mistress of Novices and tell her you disobeyed a sister.
Of course, Egwene said quickly, turning to go. She had her answer. Bayonin had not passed on traveling, and that meant she likely had not passed on anything else. Perhaps there could be a little trust. And besides, Nagora and Miyasi were advancing on her. The last thing she wanted was to be dragged bodily to Sylviana's study, something Miyasi, at least, was quite capable of. She had even stronger arms than Farana. On the morning of her ninth day back in the tower, before first light, Doasine herself came to Egwene's small room to give her morning dose of healing. Outside, rain was falling with a dull roar. The two reds who had been watching over her sleep gave her her fork root, frowning at Doasine, and hurried away. The yellow sitter snorted in contempt when the door closed behind them. She used the old method of healing that made Egwene gasp as though doused in an icy pond and left her ravenously eager for breakfast, as well as free of the pain in her bottom. That actually felt peculiar. You could adapt to anything over time, and a bruised bottom already seemed normal. But the use of the old way, the way used every time she had been given healing since being captured, reaffirmed that Bayonin had kept some secrets, though how she had managed it was still a mystery. Bayonin herself had only said that most sisters thought the tales of new weaves were merely rumors.
"You don't mean to bloody surrender, do you, child?" Doasine said, while Egwene was pulling her dress over her head. The woman's language was very much at odds with her elegant appearance, in gold-embroidered blue, with sapphires at her ears and in her hair.
"Should the Ammerlin seat ever surrender?" Egwene asked, as her head popped out at the top of her dress. She doubled her arms behind her to do up the buttons of white-dyed horn. Doasine snorted again, though not in contempt, Egwene thought.
"A brave course, child. Still, my wager is that Sylviana will bloody well have you sitting straight and walking right before much longer." But she left without calling Egwene down for naming herself the Ammerlin seat.
Egwene had yet another appointment with the Mistress of Novices before breakfast. She had not missed a day so far. And following a determined effort to undo Doasine's work in one go, her tears ceased as soon as Sylviana's strap stopped falling. When she lifted herself off the end of the writing table, where a leather pad was attached just for bending over, its surface worn down by who knew how many women, and her skirt and shift fell against her fiery skin, she felt no urge to flinch. She accepted the painful heat, welcomed it, warmed herself with it as she would have warmed her hands in front of a fireplace on a cold winter morning. There seemed a strong resemblance between her bottom and a blazing fireplace right that moment. Yet looking into the mirror, she saw an unruffled face, red-cheeked, but calm. "How could Shemarin have been reduced to accepted?" she asked, wiping her tears away with her handkerchief. "I've inquired, and there's no provision for it in Tower law." "How often have you been sent to me because of those inquiries?" Sylviana asked, hanging the split-tailed strap in the narrow cabinet alongside the leather paddle and the limber switch. "I'd think you would have given over long since."
"I'm curious. How, when there's no provision?"
"No provision, child," Sylviana said gently, as if explaining to a child in truth. "But no prohibition, either. A loophole that..."
"Well, we won't go into that. You'd only find a way to get yourself another strapping with it."
Shaking her head, she took her seat behind the writing table and rested her hands on the tabletop. "The problem was that Shemarin accepted it. Other sisters told her to ignore the edict, but once she realized pleading wouldn't change the Ammerlin's mind, she moved into the accepted's quarters." Egwene's stomach growled loudly, anxious for breakfast, but she was not done. She was actually having a conversation with Sylviana. A conversation,
however odd the topic. But why would she run away? Surely her friends didn't stop trying to talk sense into her.
Some talked sense, Sylviana said dryly. Others,
she moved her hands like the pans of a balance scale, first one up, then the other.
Others tried to force her, see sense. They sent her to me nearly as often as you were sent. I treated her visits as private penances, but she lacked your...
She stopped abruptly, leaning back in her chair and studying Egwene over steepled fingers.
Well now, you actually have me chatting. Not prohibited, certainly, yet hardly proper in these circumstances.
Go on to breakfast, she said, picking up her pen and opening the silver cap of her ink jar.
I'll mark you down for midday again, since I know you have no intention of curtsying.
The faintest hint of resignation tinged her voice. When Egwene entered the novice's dining hall, the first novice to see her stood, and suddenly there was a loud scraping of benches on the colorful floor tiles as the others rose too. They stood there at their benches in silence as Egwene walked down the center aisle toward the kitchen. Suddenly, Ashelin, a plump, pretty girl from Altara, darted into the kitchen. Before Egwene reached the kitchen door, Ashelin was back with a tray in her hands that held the usual thick cup of steaming tea and plate of bread, olives, and cheese. Egwene reached for the tray, but the olive-skinned girl hurried to the nearest table and set it down in front of an empty bench, offering a suggestion of a curtsy as she backed away. Lucky for her, neither of Egwene's escorts this morning had chosen that moment to peer into the dining hall. Lucky for all those novices on their feet. A cushion rested on the bench in front of Egwene's tray, a tattered thing that was more patches in different colors than original material, but still a cushion. Egwene picked it up and set it on the end of the table before sitting down. Welcoming the pain was easy. She basked in the warmth of her own fires. A soft susurration gusted through the room, a collective sigh. Only when she popped an olive into her mouth did the novices sit. She almost spat it out again. It was not far short of spoiled, but she was famished after her healing, so she spat only the pit into the palm of her hand and deposited it on the plate, washing the taste away with a sip of tea. There was honey in the tea. Novices got honey only on special occasions. She tried not to smile as she cleaned her plate, and clean it she did, even picking up crumbs of bread and cheese with a dampened finger. Not smiling was difficult, though. First Doacene, a sitter. Then Sylviana's resignation. Now this. The two sisters were far more important than the novices or the honey, but they all indicated the same thing. She was winning her war.